Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 181 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the Second Amendment podcast that has a little bit for everyone. I'm Weirdbeard, and with me, as always, is the most lovely hostess ever, Aaron Paulette. How are you doing, Aaron?
Why are you such a loud Muppet? Good God.
It's big energy. Big energy. We gotta wick him into the podcast early.
Big weird energy. Right. Okay. I've been having an allergy day because I live in Florida and apparently things pollinate all the time. Mm-hmm. I think it might be pine trees this time. I don't know. So yes, I've spent a lovely day with post nasal drip and going through Kleenex left and right, and I feel a bit in the throat. So that's why I'm a little bit low energy, just because. I'm done with this section. What are you doing, Weird?
Oh, I'm just sitting back. I'm wrapped up in a blanket. I got my COVID booster shot. I'm not making a preaching moment for anybody. My family, we weighed the pros and cons, and honestly speaking, it was not an easy decision. And you know, I finally just said to my wife, "Look, if you really want me to have this, if you schedule it for me, I'll show up on time." And I did, and now I'm feeling all chilly and gross. So I have myself a glass of rye. And let's make a show happen.
So you haven't manifested 5G internet powers yet.
I want to. I think that'd be great, because then I could go to nethack.alt.org and connect with the NetHack server there, and then I could play NetHack with my mind.
You are like the lamest netrunner ever.
But I'm my own special version of lame.
Ah, dear. Hey, Weird, you know what else is a special version of lame?
What's that?
Beto O'Rourke.
Oh. It's a good transition. It is a good transition.
That's why I cut you off.
Oh, yeah, Beto got some poll numbers in. I really don't get this guy. Like, was he a state senator? I'm trying to remember the last time he actually won an election.
Neither one of us have done any prep work. Neither of us care.
I mean, to be fair, it's been a while. Like, unless we've got, you know, there are listeners specifically from Texas. And maybe even not then, because Texas is a large state, and they've got a massive legislature of their own. It might be like, oh yeah, I guess he was, because he certainly was thrust onto the national stage when he was running against Ted Cruz, and got massive support. Like, I think it was like something like 60 or 70% of all of his campaign funds came from outside of the state of Texas, and. So all of these people from all around the country were tossing money at him so that he could offseat Ted Cruz, who himself was, I guess, doing poorly in popularity. I mean, I'll tip my hat. I personally don't see it. I kind of like Ted Cruz, but that's just me. But yeah, so evidently Ted Cruz was doing bad in the popularity numbers, but still good enough to beat Beto O'Rourke. And Robert Francis O'Rourke, of course, he goes by a Hispanic name because I think he thinks we're stupid.
Because nothing's more Hispanic than an Irish last name.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, according to Wikipedia, he was a representative for Texas in Congress, and he served for 6 years. Mm.
And he's a politician, so he is a practiced liar. And so, according to his own stories, it was his family housekeeper took to calling him Beto, and so he's decided for it to stick. I don't necessarily buy it, but again, nothing is more Hispanic than an Irish person who is wealthy enough to live in a place that had a housekeeper that had familiar names with the children.
So Weird Beard, I mean, low-hanging fruit aside, mm-hmm. why are we talking about him on a Second Amendment podcast?
Oh, because so some new poll numbers have come out, and he's down against Governor Abbott as governor. Beto's thrown his hat into the ring. I'm trying to remember if we mentioned a couple weeks ago when he threw his hat into the ring and declared it.
Don't think so.
Okay, yeah. My phone chimed.
I mean, if you did, it was when I was taking my sabbatical, so.
Yeah, I don't know. But my phone chimed, and it was a volunteer from the Beto O'Rourke campaign. They have my information, because when he said, hells yes, we're going to take your AR-15, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to give that man some money so he can keep playing, because we have been, as Second Amendment supporters, we have been dealing with people saying, nobody wants to take your guns. We're not coming to round up your guns. We just want common sense gun control. And Beto done went and said what they've been trying to do for decades. So, you know what? I'm going to reward him for that. I want me a shirt. So I bought myself a shirt, and that's been getting me lovely text messages from the O'Rourke campaign begging for money. And of which they said, can you give us some money to help him with his governor? I'm like, doesn't he have enough of his own?
But okay, but that was when he was running for president in 2019.
Correct.
And then, just as a brief aside, I think we all remember when Biden put his arm around O'Rourke's shoulder and said, you're going to be my gun control czar. Mm-hmm. And then the election happened, and I think the technical term is fudge. All happened. Fudge.
Gull happened, and again, I was very pleased to see that. I would really hope, and here's my prayer, is that the Biden administration is to gun control what the Trump administration was to gun rights, in which that he has said on many occasions that he is an anti-gun president, and he wants to enact all sorts of sweeping gun control laws to make us Second Amendment supporters unhappy. And so far, he hasn't really done a whole lot. And there's certainly rumblings that some really good things are going to be happening. I keep reading reports on NYSERP. I don't want to jinx it. But that looks good. But yeah, so he said he's gonna tap Beto. He was gonna be the new gun control czar, and there's no such position, but he certainly could create one, and he did not. So yeah.
So trying to wrestle this back onto the track, why are we talking about the governor's race? Because you linked an article in the show notes, and I expected, okay, well, he's running on gun control in Texas. And that article talked about abortion and Roe versus Wade and things like that. And, where's the two-way angle here?
Well, the two-way angle is that he has not backed down. I actually didn't read the full article. I just wanted to make sure that it had a link to the Quinnipiac poll that I was citing. But Beto O'Rourke has not stepped back. He wants to pass an assault weapons ban in Texas. I'll need to go dig up one of the articles where he's made that statement. But he has not. There was certainly talk that if he wanted to run for statewide office in Texas, that he would need to back off on his hardline gun control thing. And nope, not Robert Francis O'Rourke. He is doubling down on that. So while there are maybe some other issues that are going through, I wanted to point out that he is still a rabidly anti-gun politician, and really earns the rabid anti-gun nature, because he wants to completely ban and confiscate some of the most popular guns both in the United States and in Texas. And Texans, both Democrats and Republicans, don't seem to like that a whole lot. And so, yeah, his whole numbers are taking a dump. It's still fairly early, so this could turn around. But I don't know. I it seems like it's a really, really it's a bold move, Cotton. Let's see how it pans out for him.
All right, then. So, gun control is still a campaign killer. Hopefully it'll stay that way.
Yeah, I mean, at least in Texas. I mean, again, we've got Joe Biden as I mean, easily one of the most anti-gun presidents in history as far as how his campaign has been run. But again, so far, Bill Clinton still at number one on that pile as far as anti-gun presidents up there. You know, I was,
because he signed the assault weapon ban. Kids, ask your parents.
Yeah, signed the assault weapons ban and essentially was involved in the shenanigans to try to bankrupt the gun industry through frivolous lawsuits, which got us the Protection and Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. So yeah, Bill Clinton was the most like targeted anti-gun president that we have ever seen. I mean, I remember making talking to a very conservative friend of mine and pointing out that really the most at that time the most pro-gun president we have had in recent years was George W. Bush with his, you know, signing the National Parks Act, and there was a few other things. It's been a while. And all that. But I said the second most pro-gun president we've had was Barack Obama, because he also the National Parks Act went through and then it went down and then Obama brought it back in and really didn't pass any massively sweeping gun control laws as a president, though he did campaign on gun control. So, again, this is the politics of gun control are very, very weird as far as what they promise and then what they actually do.
So pivoting from gun control to controlling your guns, David, who actually works in a gun shop, is here to talk about all of the stupid, careless, and redonkulous things he has seen while working there.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. I was struggling with what to call this segment, but the best I could come up with was why gun shop employees drink, especially range officers. Many people in the firearms community think working at a gun shop would be like working in paradise. After all, we get paid to hang out in a gun store, we get to see all the newest offerings, we get an employee discount, etc. Well, yes, but actually no. While all those things are true, we also have to deal with people. Specifically, retail customers. As anyone who has worked retail can tell you, retail sucks. Among the customer-related things we deal with are those common to all retail and those specific to the firearms industry. The following is a non-exclusive list. Of course, first is the angry customer. The customer who doesn't really want a solution to their problem, they just want to rant at someone. Anyone who's worked a customer-facing job has dealt with those. Next is the customer or customer's friend who doesn't know as much as they think they do. Everything from recommending a new shooter start with a .38 Special snub-nose revolver, to the only reliable defensive caliber being their preferred caliber, to insisting the AR in AR-15 stands for assault rifle. For our newer listeners, AR is the first two letters of Armalite, the developer of the rifle, followed by the model number. It does not stand for Armalite rifle or assault rifle. Over the past almost 2 years now, another drain on our time and energy is the ammo call. Starting in March of last year, we had a constant stream of calls asking if we had this or that caliber in stock. For much of that time, our answer was a regretful no. This issue got so bad, management had to schedule employees to do nothing but answer the phone from half an hour before we opened to closing time. Thankfully, that issue has mostly been resolved. When a customer purchases a firearm elsewhere and has it transferred to our store, they can often track delivery. All too frequently, we've had customers call or show up at the store inquiring about their gun before the receiving clerk has even opened the box. This is in spite of the clear instructions to wait for us to let them know their gun is ready for pickup. The items I've already covered are aggravating or annoying. This next group of issues is less pleasant. As, hopefully, everyone has been trained, it's important to be aware of muzzle direction and to avoid pointing it at anyone. This is also called flagging them with the muzzle. Yet in the store, this is a constant occurrence. If I had a dollar for every time I've had a gun pointed at me by a customer, I'd be able to afford at least one more moderately priced gun, or at least half a dozen of the kind Oddball is attracted to. When a gun is brought in for service or as a trade-in, the first thing we always do is check the chamber. Nearly every customer will state some form of, "Don't worry, it's not loaded," when we do this. A much smaller number of customers are actually correct. My favorite memory of this was the time a customer was insistent their trade-in pistol wasn't loaded. When the clerk racked the slide, a loaded round was ejected. The clerk looked down, then locked eyes with the customer and kept racking the slide, ejecting round after round until it was empty. Not only did the gun have a round in the chamber, but the magazine was full as well. Usually it's not that exciting. Then there's customer antics on the range. When acting as range safety officers, not only do we get flagged by even more muzzles, but there is a much higher likelihood of those guns being loaded and fingers being on the triggers. Speaking of fingers on triggers, negligent discharges are always of great concern on the range. Just to clarify, an accidental discharge is when a firearm malfunctions and discharges a shot without a precipitating action by a person. A negligent discharge is when a person discharges a shot without intending to, but still performing the required action to do so. We regularly see shots hit range fixtures, target hangers, walls, floors, and ceilings. There's a reason ranges need to be constructed to specific standards. Not only does the physical structure of the range get shot on a regular basis, but other range property takes some damage as well. Not long ago, a customer rented a range gun with a suppressor on it. As happens, the suppressor loosened slightly during firing and unfortunately suffered a baffle strike. This launched the suppressor downrange to be recovered later. When the range was finally cold and the RSO went to retrieve the suppressor, he found it had acquired an additional hole in the middle of its side. Yep, another customer had seen the suppressor downrange and center punched it with a shot. Not all range issues deal with shots being fired, though they span from unwise to foolhardy. Like the guys who were asked to leave after posing for a range selfie while pointing guns at each other. Or the shooter trying to clear a malfunction in his AK off the firing line and pointing his muzzle at the window into the store area. My personal favorite is the fellows we found downrange after the range went cold, filling a backpack with all the brass they could gather. My range has no issue with customers collecting their own brass or even a bit more, but going beyond the firing line to fill a backpack? That's a bit much. There's a reason we have certain range rules and have customers watch a safety video and sign a waiver. There's also a reason for the trope of the gun shop employee who drinks heavily after their shift. Unfortunately, I don't have that relief valve.
Do you have anything else you have to say?
Please don't put me in the box again.
Can we skip your fetish and get on with the podcast, please?
Fair enough.
That about wraps up this segment. If you have any questions for me or suggestions for future segments or a comment on a past segment, please post them on the Assorted Calibers Podcast Facebook or MeWe pages, and Aaron or Weird will make sure I get them. I'm also a contributor on the Blue Collar Prepping blog, which can be found at bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
So there's a Facebook group called, I think it's Gun Shop and Range Stories. And I mean, I got in, but I think I might have gotten in on the good recommendation of someone else. I don't know if anyone can get in if you answer the questions correctly. But if you go there and you read the comments or well, the posts and the comments written by people who do this for a living. Oh, good Lord. It's you know, there are times when I read this that it makes me go, you know, maybe some people shouldn't have guns. I don't know really how to phrase it without making it sound like I'm pro gun control or whatever, but there are some people it's like, yeah, we need to take away your driver's license and anything sharp.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, well, first up, I just got to say, like, David's opening line of the, oh, yeah, you get to, you know, see all the latest and greatest and handle all the things and all that. And it's, you know, it's absolutely true. I mean, David loves his job. let's not get the title of this segment to get in the way. He loves working where he works. I mean, we've heard lots of stories that he's told about how happy he is working there. But at the same time, it reminds me of, it was Scott Adams who had a great line, which was that all work has to suck, because if it didn't suck, you'd just do it for free. You know, you think about all the stuff that you do for free or you pay money to do. Skiing. Skiing's a great example. I only skied for a little while. I wasn't a huge fan of it, so I stopped doing it. But man, you could shell out a ton of money, both on equipment and lift tickets and travel to go to the mountains and all that. You know, if you're really hardcore and you do like a ski vacation where you stay at a ski resort and all that, you could dump a ton of money and it's just go up to the top of the mountain and then go back down the mountain again. And people shell out huge money for that. And then, you know, meanwhile, today was trash day and those gentlemen were on the back of that truck and hauling the trash. And I got to say, I always, whenever I'm around and the trash guys come through, I always make sure to say thank you because good Lord, I am happy to see the trash go away. And I've got relatives that live in rural areas where they need to haul their own garbage. And I'm very, very pleased that I don't have to do that. So I'm very appreciative and thankful for that job. And we pay them because I don't want to do it. So yeah, there is that angle. But also, I remember at one point I was in a gun shop. And there was two guys talking about home invasion. And I believe, and I heard, I think this was all in one instant. It's like rapid fire where the guy behind the counter recommended that he load his shotgun with birdshot. That way it would limit over penetration of walls.
All you have to do is spackle and repaint.
Yeah. And then also said, if you end up shooting somebody, if you end up shooting someone, it turns out they are armed. Go into your kitchen and get a knife and put it in their hand before you call the cops. And I'm just like, oh, why? And just, okay, I have seen some tests where people are using birdshot on various ballistic targets, from ballistic gel to pork shoulders and things like that. And I certainly would not want to get shot with birdshot. But also at the same time, like anything that's not going to penetrate drywall is not going to penetrate a target in any reliable fashion.
And I would rather be shot with birdshot than shot by .22.
Oh, hands down. If I had to choice. So yeah, I just see that it's like one of those, like, you do this for a living. And you're giving this awful advice, and in no way, shape, or form manipulate a crime scene after you've had to shoot somebody. Like, the chances are that you're in the right, and but yet if you go and like put a knife in their hand or drag them back up onto your porch so that they're on your property or whatever those goofy myths about, like, oh, make sure you dress up the crime scene so it looks good when the police get there. You've just committed a crime yourself, and that you may have just thrown away your chances of defending yourself if you get caught doing that. But the idea of all of the people flagging me. We talked about this with the Alec Baldwin thing on the always checking the gun. Is I have had one instance where someone has handed me an unloaded gun and I have opened the action and a round came out, but anybody I've ever talked to who's worked at a gun shop for any length of time has, like, just piles and piles of ammunition that they have pulled out of quote unquote unloaded guns. So yeah, the sweeping of the safety and
again at gun shop and range stories, there are frequently, well, I don't know about frequently, but there are more than two gun shops that have, instead of a tip jar, an it's unloaded jar, mm-hmm. into which they drop the bullet. Yeah. And some of them are unfortunately full. Not like full, but I mean, you know, in an ideal world, it would be empty. You would expect a few, and it's like, no, that's a couple of fingers worth. Mm-hmm. Dang.
Yeah, no, I think it was David who was linking someone talking about what they do with the ammunition that this was a gunsmith, what they do with the ammunition that they find in the unloaded guns that are given to him to do work on. And it's just like, oh boy. And I think they were talking about, like, I think the guy ended up mentioning he had a high point that he could shoot up some of the 9mm with, because you can't blow them up. Well, I can't shift gears as smoothly as Aaron Paulette can, because Aaron's better than me
in every possible way.
Yes, but I sat down with Paloma Capon, and of course we know she's been covering the January 6th protest and the treatment of the protesters, and she found this really strange tale of an Army veteran who was arrested after the protest. So I am pleased to welcome back to the Assorted Calibers podcast, lawyer Paloma Capana. And we've all been reading Paloma's blog, right? 2 a.m. Patriots. Just great title. And it's an amazing blog with all sorts of information, mostly on the events of January 6th. And you have another story from January 6th to share with us.
I do. Good morning and hello to listeners of Assorted Calibers podcast. So today, the lawyer in me would like to bring you a case study in FBI retribution. It's pretty rare that I have an example that is sufficiently clear that as an attorney, I know I have in front of me the evidence to back up, you know, my characterization and that it's more than just a gut feeling. So Jeremy Michael Brown, age 47, out of Tampa, Florida. Let's just go through the basic facts here. Yes, he's at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, 2021. Mr. Brown is a former Green Beret. He is a decorated veteran. He has been awarded 2 Bronze Stars. And in fact, among his resume points is the nifty little fact that he was even a poster boy during his days of active service. At age 28, he was featured on a recruitment poster. I mention this because it actually becomes part of the FBI retribution down the road. I'm going to sort of drop you into the date of March 5th. On March 5th, Jeremy Brown, who had not been arrested yet for the events of January 6th, does a 2-hour interview on band.video. And you'll find a link to that. I think Weird Beard, you're probably going to put it up in the show notes.
Yep,
I've emailed it to you.
All set up, yep.
Great, great. And I would actually say to listeners, you know, even if you haven't done anything or read anything about January 6th, check out this interview, especially because it's one that might at some point get, you know, erased from the deep six that the state tends to give things. But in this 2-hour interview, Mr. Brown actually gives a primer in PSYOPs, in psychological operations. He uses his training from the U.S. military. He quotes from things like the Unconventional Warfare booklet, which is freely available on the internet, I point out. And he also details and shows video of the FBI sending 2 agents to the front door of his house for a ring the doorbell ahead of January 6th. So this is a guy who did enough intelligence that his little bungalow in Tampa, Florida is surrounded by 17 cameras. And the video is clear, probably clearer than the video in the Kyle Rittenhouse case. And you can even hear the audio of the 2 agents asking for him and then asking to meet with him. Mr. Brown does end up agreeing to meet with them. He sits down with them and he has an audio of that meeting. He starts by asking the FBI agents if he can record it. They say yes. Fascinating audio. He also narrates that audio. And a key point in the audio is one of the agents says, look, on a scale from 1 to 10 of who are we concerned with in the Tampa area, you are a 0. So keeping all those factors in mind, January 6th and January 7th, the FBI actually calls Mr. Brown on his cell phone. So while he's at the Capitol, while he's standing on the grass you know, here's the FBI calling, hello, where are you? And Mr. Brown takes those calls, both the 6th and the 7th. So in my own little mind, in terms of the near 700 other defendants who have been arrested concerning the events of January 7, we tend to see that people are arrested about as early as January 12th. So starting with Thomas Caldwell, one of my subject defendants. And, you know, the bulk of people are really arrested by the summer. Then you get some stringers. They still have some faces that they have up on their, you know, most wanted from January 6th hit list, where they're looking for more tips from the public. But it's not like Jeremy Brown was hiding. He was doing interviews. He was out in public. He was identified in his photo wearing his tactical gear January 6th at the U.S. Capitol. My gut feeling when I saw his arrest finally come through on September 29th was that they had hung him out. But my initial question was, well, did they leave him out there because they flipped him? In other words, because he was trying to gather information concerning the Oath Keepers. So as people who go to the 2 a.m. Patriot website or people who have bought my book know, my focus since January 6th has been on defendants tagged as being an Oath Keeper. Mr. Brown's position is that he got interested in the Oath Keepers November of 2020, so just a couple of months before the events of January 6th, and that almost as soon as he was in touch with the Oath Keepers, the FBI was in touch with him. So, you know, he gets arrested finally end of September, and as I said, my question is, okay, which side is he on in this whole thing? That's where the strange series of legal events begin that kind of lead me to my conclusion of FBI retribution, because initially he's arrested and processed through federal court in Tampa, Florida, and he is assigned case number, and I'll just shorthand the very long number that goes with cases. So he's assigned case number 619. He's in front of a magistrate judge. And immediately, US DOJ moves to transfer that case to Washington, D.C. This is still standard in terms of how they're processing January 6th defendants. Case gets transferred to Washington, D.C. Case gets assigned a new case number. That's case number 609. And then I get my first interesting blip, because when a case gets brought into court, it hits what's called the random assignment wheel. So whoever is the next judge is whoever gets assigned to the case. Well, US DOJ was not happy with that outcome. So they requested the case be transferred to Judge Amit Mehta, M-E-H-T-A. Judge Mehta has essentially the 20 other defendants claimed to be Oath Keepers already in his courtroom by this time, starting with the first one, Thomas Caldwell, January 12th. And Judge Mehta, interestingly, in the public notes that you can read on the court docket, says why. You know, subtext there, folks, for a little bit of, you know, humor is like, I don't have enough cases already. Why, you know, why do you want to come into my courtroom? And US DOJ files paperwork that says because it's related to the other case of Thomas Caldwell et al. That is already before you. So me, I'm thinking, here's my cliffhanger. Fantastic, right? They're going to bring him in. They're going to arraign him. They're going to do a pretrial detention hearing. And I'm going to get to know, is he working for the FBI or is he still a civilian? And nothing happens. Nothing happens. Zero. For 7 weeks, absolutely nothing happens. I'm staring at docket number 609, waiting for action, and there's nothing. So I go in search of Mr. Brown. I go into the prison locator system. He's not showing. There is no defense attorney listed. And my rule for how I have been conducting all my research since January 6th started is not to get involved. I'm simply working with public records. I'm digging, I'm sleuthing. And honestly, I really haven't hit this kind of an issue before. But in this instance, I was really wishing there was a defense attorney so that I could at least say, is he still breathing? Because if you watch the 2-hour video, he also claims in that video he will not take a plea if he gets arrested. He's going to go to trial because he has the information that will blow the lid off January 6th and cause all the defendants to be released. So, you know, in my own little mind, and Weird Beard, you may share this sentiment, you're thinking to yourself, is this guy at risk, right? Is this the first American that's literally had a bag put over his head as he's been taken into the prison? Can't find him. Call the U.S. Marshals Service. Takes me 4 days to get through to anybody in Tampa at that office. And they say, okay, yes, he is still in custody. But still, I have no arraignment anywhere. So I finally break down and call the federal court in Tampa where he first came in. That clerk can't tell me either, but agrees that the record showing for case both 619, which they had enclosed, and 609 that Judge Beda has, is looking as if he got lost in the system. I talked actually with Weird Beard just a couple days ago. I'm telling him Mr. Brown is missing, and I'm thinking this just can't be right. So for about 90 minutes on Monday night, Antiques Roadshow is on for diversion, and I'm typing at my computer, and I hit a tiny little article out of a Tampa Bay newspaper that references a Judge Flynn. Okay, I don't have a Judge Flynn on the other two docket numbers, which led me to say, okay, there has to be another docket number here. So I started manipulating my search strings and a couple other bits of magic. And lo and behold, they're not pursuing Mr. Brown under the January 6th charges. They've charged him with two different counts. Both are federal misdemeanors. Oh no, they're pursuing him with federal felonies in a totally different case, case number 1991 in Florida on gun charges. Stop the press.
Yeah.
Weird Beard is like, wait a minute, what does she mean gun charges? Okay, so still, the statement holds, there was no person at the Capitol that day arrested for anything relating to firearms. There's no firearms charges related to January 6th. They snagged him when they went for the arrest. So when they went to his house to arrest him and with a search warrant, they now are alleging to have firearms and two grenades that are in violation of various provisions of federal law. That happens to be a felony. And literally, those felony charges within the last about 24, 48 hours, the attorneys finally put in statements to the judge who has the gun case saying, oh, yeah, we should put the other one on hold because that's just a misdemeanor. Now, why defense counsel is agreeing to this, who knows? But what they had also done is revealed in a fourth case that was filed, the 3138 case. US DOJ went in and got a Patriot Act level subpoena to tap Mr. Brown's phone as of September 29 going forward. So if you put those dates together, they arrest him on the January 6th charges. They get a Patriot Act subpoena to tap his phone. They also get a delay on the release of that warrant information and application for 30 days, including to the defendant. And in the meantime, they put together enough. He doesn't do very well with women, Mr. Brown. Those seem to be the key complainants against him, tend to be the ex-wife, the girlfriends in his life. I say that with a touch of humor as a woman, but the road leads to him being arrested on federal felony charges 10 months after the fact of January 6th. There's no allegation that any of those firearms were anywhere near the Capitol. That's just completely irrelevant. But the FBI has extracted their pound of flesh for the interview that he gave. And here's the little tiny, if you will, detail that is the cherry on top of my argument. The DOJ exhibit list on October 5th at pretrial detention includes separately numbered that when they went to his house to do the arrest and do the search, that they seized his copy of Unconventional Warfare, the PSYOPs booklet. Now, I know there's restrictions on what I can say on air, but I think the listeners get that that's the flip the bird to Mr. Brown.
Oh, so, I mean, So the allegation is, while they were investigating him for January 6th, they discovered some firearms, and I assume, since you're saying federal, that they're possibly in violation of the NFA. You also mentioned grenades.
So right.
That would be our explosives, machine guns, short-barreled rifles. I don't know how much detail you have on the...
Shocking amount of detail is actually what got me a bit, and I think it's also... Again, it's yet another one of those subtle details a lawyer can pick up on. They go right down to the serial number without redacting anything in terms of the firearms and the descriptions. I mean, they're manufacturer issue. There is no allegation he bench built these firearms. You know, they're manufacturer named, modeled. They include, of course, in his case, photographs of the big black scary guns, which the media then plastered everywhere. So, you know, you see in this scenario how the FBI, how the DOJ have actually manipulated a person's life to get back at him, as opposed to arresting him. They could have done it as early as January 15th, basis the media interviews he was doing, basis the photograph of himself at the Capitol, straight face on, facial recognition software would have had him, right? But they didn't. They completely strung him out. Punishment that he wouldn't cooperate in talking about the Oath Keepers, I don't know. But it certainly grew to the point, I think it's very reasonable to say, where they punished him for the interview that he did, for taping them, for filming them, and then for doing essentially, as I said, a tutorial on psychological operations. It's really not that different than Jessica Watkins' case, where in that evidence list, they went in to do the arrest and do the warrant execution. And in that case, funnily enough, they left the firearms at her residence, but they took her copy of the Anarchist's cookbook. And they made a point to the media that includes recipes on how to build bombs. Well, I have news for the FBI. It's for sale on Amazon. I mean, the Anarchist Cookbook has been around for decades, and it's freely available at Amazon.com.
I downloaded a copy for free somewhere in a PDF dump back in the early days of the internet.
Right. So you see these tiny little, I call them little signatures, right? When you get these odd little FU twists, where it's just that act of perversion, really, where there's almost like this sadistic thrill that the agent or agents have taken, that even the DOJ attorneys adopt as part of the message that they want to send and they want to get out there. And here is even one more little, you know, perversion of their arrest of Mr. Brown. There's a photograph that they took of his bedroom. As a trial attorney, I can tell you it is completely irrelevant. It is not related to the charges in any of these cases. It is not probative of a single sentence of several hundred pages worth of government documents. But what they did was they took his poster from when he was active military, that recruiting poster, which Mr. Brown had beautifully framed up with his medals, and they put it onto the pillows of his bed. And they took a photograph of the bed with his poster on the pillows. And it's clearly a wall hanging, and it's clearly in excellent condition and was either hanging somewhere in his house or they found it in a closet, but they've put Mr. Brown to bed.
What was he charged with for the January 6th case?
So he has the two standard charges, if you will. The charge of disorderly or disruptive conduct in a restrictive building or grounds. The essential allegation of the DOJ is any person that came within a area they now have circled around the Capitol was part of the mob. And even the least actor, they want to hold to the standard of the highest actor. So you could have been standing on a blade of grass, and if somebody inside had taken a flagpole and struck or threatened a law enforcement officer, they want to charge the person standing on the grass as contributing to the most heinous of any criminal activity that occurred that day. So that's that charge. You see that on just about everybody. And then there's a one provision different, entering and remaining in a restricted building or grounds. So it's all under 18 U.S.C. section 1752 A1 and A2. You know, that there are no particular allegations that Mr. Brown has threatened anyone with a firearm, threatened anybody with grenades. In fact, I think his attorney makes a very interesting argument. You know, the fact that everything was safely stored, the fact that he has no prior criminal charges. So he, and that's confirmed with the DOJ, no prior criminal charges for Mr. Brown. And yet here they go, now making him into a new poster boy for the American terrorist veteran.
But since there's no weapons allegations on there, how is it that they came to inspect his firearms collection?
Because of a tip that there might be some in an RV next to his house.
I gotcha. So it was they were quote unquote tipped off. So the firearms were seized under a separate warrant.
Yes, they were. Okay. Completely separate case. Separate judge, separate warrant, separate indictment, the whole enchilada, completely separate. And so that's how, if you're tracking January 6th, you know, here's this sideways diversion that then has become the primary case, plus the phone tap is still a completely separate docket number. I will be today uploading that 50-page application for the phone tap. Not to be completely nerdy, and Mr. Brown, if you're listening, I apologize for getting excited about anything relating to your case. But I do think that Mr. Brown would appreciate my excitement. This may be the only complete example I have ever seen of a Patriot Act warrant application for a phone tap. These things don't surface, but it showed up on Scribd. So I'll upload it also to my website. Absolutely fascinating to read and to see the construction of it. And once again, here's this tiny little legal detail. They have it filed as a civil miscellaneous case. So they don't even comment to the judge, you know, hey, we're after a big bad American terrorist here. They simply book it as a civil miscellaneous case. I have to question whether the judge even read it. Because when you really go through the content, you know, to me, I'm sort of on the fence of, and this relates to national security, how, right? Because there's no allegation in there that he had these weapons at the Capitol on January 6th, that there's no allegations he had them in the ready in the state of Virginia with a rapid response team, you know, who was going to bring them in, right? They've just got this, we need to know this because he's got guns and he's a veteran. And I mean, essentially, when you take all of these papers together, the essential smear, if you will, is that he's a crazy vet, is the essential portrait that they try to paint, is one of the best and the brightest, once featured in a poster for recruiting brave young men, now losing his marbles, is the essential argument. And they've prevailed. Right. He's pretrial detained, and his attorneys did file a second motion to say, hey, judge, you know, please reconsider this. They made some very good arguments. As recently as last week, the judge reaffirmed, nope, he's staying in jail pending trial. Here's the order date I'm looking for. November 11. As recently as November 11, the judge said, no, you know, I'm not reconsidering this. He's staying in prison. So if we want to then actually take this case study in Mr. Brown and go somewhere with it, we have two areas to cover. One is the FBI question. And Weird Beard, you, me, and the listeners of Assorted Calibers podcast could probably put on a full-day symposium that people would come to live from all over the country to discuss that issue, right, of what should be the limits on FBI conduct, how honest do they need to be in their pursuit of the bad guys, how quickly do they need to execute on arrests and warrant applications and so forth. So we've got that piece. But in Mr. Brown's case, if the DOJ is to be believed, the deeper and I think the much sadder question and why it's important for us to discuss him is you take a vet who you claim is mentally unstable and you simply drop him into the prison system, what are we doing to evaluate that mental health condition? What are we doing in case, for example, it is a vet with PTSD? Now you stick him in a cell, and if they do end up transferring him up to the Washington, D.C. prison system, which is what I had assumed would happen when they transferred the case to Judge Maeda, you're talking about a prison that is operating on 23-hour a day solitary confinement on the claim that they have to do that for COVID mitigation. So, you know, the left, if you will, in 2020 wanted to claim exclusivity, that only the people to whom they were shining a spotlight were not receiving mental health services. And that's really a corruption of the argument, because the U.S. prison system doesn't have mental health services on an inbound screening level with any kind of legal opportunity for designing therapeutic approach concurrent with pretrial, concurrent with serving sentences. So, you know, at the end of the day, perhaps Mr. Brown stands for a couple things. You know, one is, if you've committed a crime and the FBI isn't picking you up, it could be because they're looking for bigger and better ways to get you. But the second is, shame on the FBI. If you really think that someone is decompensating, why are you leaving them out there? Why are you putting this kind of pressure of simply playing cat and mouse with them? Why are you trying to convert them to become informants for you? I mean, are you bringing them in to become a confidential informant because you then are also offering them counseling on a weekly basis? I don't think so, right? You're simply using them up and then spitting them back out. So hopefully our listeners have, you know, some espresso waiting for them when they get done with this segment with us. But it really is a unique example of the myriad of ways in which the events of January 6th should be giving us who support the Second Amendment things to think about going forward, not only in how we conduct our activist activities, but also what do we need to be doing for each other when there's a potential that someone has crossed the line? How do we help them? I mean, even now, for example, if I wanted to send Mr. Brown a card just to say, somebody out here is tracking your case, where do you send it? Where do you send it? A divorced guy with several unhappy ex-girlfriends and an ex-wife, you know, where do you just send a card just to let someone know, thank you for your service, I'm watching your case, so that they don't feel completely isolated?
I mean, it almost reads like a Robert Ludlum novel, yet this is reality.
Yeah. Yeah, right. There's two or three where the movie version, whether it's Tom Cruise or, I'm picturing him in any event, where a couple of the actors from their facial expressions, right, they really communicate the whole, I've served my country, I've done what you've asked me to do, and now what of me? What of me? What becomes of me in this situation? So not only does he then, say whether he's convicted or whether he is found not guilty, at some point he comes back, right, into society. He now walks with not only the status of veteran, which this country is not doing enough for, is not treating with sufficient respect, and he then walks with potentially federal felony in his background. And so what is that future?
Well, it's sad that this is not, you know, national news. There aren't agencies, you know, news agencies all over, you know, the country that are following these cases. We get a similar statement from Stephen Gutowski of The Reload, where he just keeps pointing out the fact that, why am I the only one following these Second Amendment cases?
Yes, yes. And many days I feel like I'm in solitary confinement myself. You know, there's a strange reaction almost that I get. I do a number of gun shows. I do workshops, and people are always fascinated and curious with what I have to say, and they have some questions about January 6th or particular defendants, and most specifically about the shooting death of Ashley Babbitt. But then there's also this feeling that, okay, we don't really want to know as much as you know, because we don't want to get emotionally connected with all of this. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have to. I mean, we really do. It's not enough to say, oh, I support the Second Amendment. And I think it's easy to draw the line where it's, okay, here's someone in Baltimore, here's someone in Chicago, and they've shot and murdered somebody, you know, at night over a pack of cigarettes. That person goes to jail, right? It's easy enough to say, I myself would not simply walk out and randomly shoot someone for a pack of cigarettes. I think that's fair. I can say I'm sufficiently rational, and at 55 years old, I've got enough miles beneath my feet that I think I can make that claim and we can all be confident. But I think you never do know where that flashpoint would be for you, where you feel a tipping point, whether it's a home invasion or you believe that this may be the last time that you're hearing the president, President Trump, speak in public. And as a number of the defendants have said, and the DOJ has even put in papers, people thought it was the last time they were going to hear President Trump speak while he was in office. And yet now here they are facing federal felony charges.
Crazy. Well, thank you for keeping an eye on this case. And of course, you will come back when you get more information.
I will. And if somehow anybody knows Mr. Brown, you know, pass along that there are people trying to watch for his case, trying to be sure that justice is served.
Well, thank you so much, Paloma Capanna.
Thank you, Weird Beard, and all the listeners to Assorted Calibers podcast.
Yeah, I'm just going to pour myself some rum, because, that's not good.
No, I have to say this because I really think it's a little pulling back the curtain, but literally this interview started as a discussion of the DC prison system, which she mentions briefly at the end, but like we pretty much did half of an interview talking about the DC prison system. And she was mentioning this strange case of this guy, Jeremy Brown, who was arrested and was assigned a court case and all that, and just kind of disappeared. And she didn't know where he was. And I don't know if I think she came up with a couple of ideas on where she could look further. And pretty much after we hung up, she contacted me like, I think a couple hours later and said, I found him. I figured out why he disappeared and why he's not in DC. And you heard the whole story just now. Mm-hmm. And she says, I don't want you to publish that interview that we just did. And I said, you know, overall, the information you told me isn't too bad. Just give me a rundown and I can fill out the, no, I just want to re-record it. So we recorded the entire interview over again, which was no big deal, honestly, because the it's the editing that takes up the most amount of time. And I like sitting down and talking to Paloma. She's super nice. But yeah, she has that level of integrity that she's like, no, you can't use that interview because I want to do it again and I want to do it better. And this is just like a really, really interesting case. And she's got a couple of blog posts up on them that can be found in the show notes. And I found some of the pictures of the firearms allegedly seized from his place. They appear to be a short barreled rifle and a short barrel, definitely a short barreled shotgun. But I assume from the AR style rifle that they seized, it looks like the barrel is on the shorter side. It might be intricately suppressed. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to find too much information specifically about why these guns ran afoul with the NFA. But oh boy, it really does read like a Robert Ludlum article.
Yeah, I mean, as she was describing it, it's so cliche, but I experienced a roller coaster of emotions. Like, wow, that sounds shady. I wonder if he is an asset, and they're they haven't arrested him because he's doing this, that, and the other thing. And then he turns out he's arrested for this other thing. And so he went through several permutations of guilty and innocent in my mind until we finally got to the end. And then, oh, crap, really?
And I listened to the better part of the interview that she's talking about, and that's also in the show notes. And I saved a copy of it for my own personal, just in case it does disappear. But he met with the agents came and knocked on his door, and then they called him later on. He knocked on the door. And his girlfriend answered the door because they were expecting a tradesman to come by, because he tells her, don't if you look in the door and you don't know who it is, it's them. And they weren't in uniform. They were just in plain clothes. So she assumed it was a technician coming to fix a broken AC. And so they actually did. He actually did come to the door to see who she was talking to, realized they were law enforcement officers, and did not let them know that he was who they were looking for. And so they moved on, and then probably figured it out looking at photographs and such. So they called him up and arranged a meeting, and he recorded it. And it really absolutely sounds like in the meeting that the agents were trying to flip him and get him to become mm-hmm. an informant on the Oath Keepers. So yeah, I think he went through the they tried to flip him, and clearly he didn't flip, because if he didn't, he would not be sitting in a prison cell right now. So yeah, it's so shady what is going on within all of this.
I wish I had more to add, but I don't.
Yeah.
At this point, my life has basically been reduced to, please, Lord, let me live long enough to see the heads of my enemies float down the river.
Mm-hmm. And, well, we'll keep living on. We can always hope. Well, I will again poorly shift gears to thank all of our listeners. I mean, it's so great that you are listening to this show, because why would we be talking to nobody? And a special thanks to all the supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcalibrespodcast to sign up. Patrons get early release of the podcast, plus there's bonus content. We got blooper reels, we got the ACP film track, and we have the ACP mag dump.
That was so low energy for you. Also, please remember to rate us on Apple Podcasts, subscribe to us on platform of your choice, and share us with your friends, both online and off. I don't care.
I feel challenged. You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com. And hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network with Ryan Machad. He's so lovely.
His skin is soft and supple. And I hear tell he is a gentle and considerate lover.
I mean, one does not kiss and tell, Aaron Paulette.
You can find more from me at the regular places. I'm going to pimp Lurking Rhythmically, which is my nerd blog, because I'm trying to get back into some of my creative writing. And this will interest approximately one of you. The other day, I wrote a story about one of the superheroes. I played an online superhero game, and her name is Caffeine Kate. And a lot of people went, that's really cool, that's really funny. So for that one listener who goes to check it out, thank you so much.
And very special thanks to Nate Spencer, who is doing our music.
So Weird is swaddled up, not feeling well, and I'm sitting here drinking hot water and rum, and none of this is very exciting, to be honest, because we're all feeling a little So our coping mechanisms are assorted, and so is our podcast, and it's winter. What do you want from me? It'll be Christmas next week.
Good night, everybody.
Yeah, jingle, jingle, mother.
Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night!